This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for October 28, 2013. We missed a couple of weeks during the government shutdown when there were no rulings, no court cases, nothing federal to report, but we're back with some very interesting items this week. Let's describe them and then we'll get started with our discussion. First, we thought you might be interested in how many tax return preparers actually have preparer tax ID numbers. Then, we thought you might also like to know that if you don't pay your taxes, the government can throw you in jail. Then we have a lesson in something called the duty of consistency, in that once you have chosen a path of tax valuation, you must stay on that path, even in later years after the statute of limitations is closed on the year of the initial valuation. A case involving a real estate developer reminds us that the nature of what income would be when we sell the right to receive that income doesn't change. So that if I sell the right to receive ordinary income, what I get is going to be ordinary income, not capital gain. Then a classic activity in which the losses are not deductible because the activity was not conducted in a business-like way. And that's followed by a real surprise. In the Jeffrey Furnish decision, the IRS was not permitted by the court to rely on a 1099 for its face, but rather lost because they could not support or prove that the information reported on the 1099 was actually supported in substance by the underlying facts. Finally, I thought you might be interested in the internal guidance that is provided to those who make decisions on collection due process hearings. Determining the timeliness of a taxpayer's collection due process or equivalent hearing request, and that should be of interest to those of us that work in collection matters. So it's a wide-ranging topic list. Let's get started. Here are the numbers for those tax preparers who have applied for and hold preparer tax identification numbers for 2013. Total, 690,059. Of those, attorneys are 31,972. Certified public accountants, 214,267. Enrolled actuaries, 471. Enrolled agents, 46,795. Enrolled retirement plan agents, 646, and in other categories, supervised preparers, 62,533, and non-1040 preparers, 50,858. Frankly, I thought the numbers would be higher, but perhaps I think there are more of us than there really are. Next, in United States versus Francis Leroy McLean, a U.S. District Court, reconsidering its decision on remand from the Court of Appeals, denied an individual's motion to vacate, set aside, or correct his prison sentence for failing to pay employment taxes related to his temporary staffing agency. The district court found that the Eighth Circuit had previously rejected all of the arguments on direct appeal and that his remaining arguments introduced on the remand lacked merit. Mr. McLean owned and operated a business, actually a business that was run under several different names, that supplied temporary nursing staff to nursing homes and other health care facilities. He was convicted by a jury of 9 counts of failing to account for and pay over employment taxes on those employees and was originally sentenced to 48 months in jail and a $75,000 fine. And this, by the way, is the third instance in the last 5 years that we have observed, and we may have missed some, in which individuals who have failed to remit their withheld payroll taxes have been sentenced to prison terms. And it seems to be more likely to happen with the so-called staffing companies where they're handling a lot of payroll money and a lot of tax money. So we as CPAs should be on the alert for that, because if the staffing agency does not pay the payroll taxes for the employees that work for us, our client may be obligated to pay them. And that's a financial disaster in most cases. Our next case is a duty of consistency decision. Brett Van Allen, TC Memo 2013-235. Mr. Van Allen and his sister were found to be liable for capital gains taxes on the sale of an easement on a ranch they inherited the duty of consistency, according to the court, applied, and the basis of the brother and sister in the property was established by the value reported on the estate tax return over a decade earlier based on a Section 2032A farm, active farm property election. There are, as you might expect, a lot of complexities to this case and some amusing sidelights, but the bottom line is this. When the dad died, the stepmother made a Section 2032A election in order to reduce the value of property and minimize a taxable estate. The stepmother is gone, dad is gone, the children are now the beneficiaries of a trust which is holding the farm property whose value was significantly diminished by the 2032A election. When an easement was sold for $900,000, there was significantly less basis, as the gain was almost the entire amount of the easement sale, and the children tried to argue that they should be given some special break for the fair market value of the land at the time. And then they tried to argue that the easement wasn't really a sale of the land. But, you know, when you sell an easement, you have to allocate your basis between the fee, the surface rights, and whatever you give up in the value of the easement. In any event, the duty of consistency applies so that the basis which is determined for purposes of the estate tax return of the deceased parent is the basis that carries through and carries over that through the hands of two administrators and into a trust for the benefit of the brother and sister. Again, that's Van Allen, TC Memo 2013-235. Next, in Philip D. Long, TC Memo 2013-233, the tax court, sustaining an accuracy-related penalty in addition to the tax assessment, denies a deduction for legal fees claimed by a real estate developer and finds that the amount he received when he assigned a project that was in process but unfinished to another developer is ordinary income, and he must include in his ordinary income the portion of that fee he paid to a corporation under another agreement that did not, in fact, create a joint venture. So the principal points here are that if a real, to think of it this way, if, and let's use the example, real estate developer is developing a condominium project which will produce ordinary income. The project planning is underway, the building's even out of the ground. Now, if the real estate developer proceeds with the condominium development, the sale of all the condominiums will produce ordinary income. But in this case, the real estate developer sold the condominium development in midstream, got something north of $5 million, and tried to report that as a capital gain. Well, it can't be a capital gain because the nature of the income is ordinary income. I cannot assign my right to receive ordinary income to another and treat the proceeds as capital gain. That's the most significant lesson in Philip D. Long, the one we should remember. The other secondary lesson we should remember is that usually a joint venture is going to be evidenced by some sort of written agreement, not by a loose providing of funds at various times. The individual that Mr. Long tried to claim was a co-venturer was in fact someone who had simply advanced some money for one project, not even this project. So it's a complicated case. And any of you who work for real estate developers know that they have a capacity to complicate things, and this is certainly a complicated decision. But the point, remember, is that I cannot treat as capital gain what the sales proceeds from selling something that, if I completed it, would provide ordinary income for me. That's the assignment of income doctrine, or at least a variation of it. Now we have Patrick Schlievert, TC Memo 2013-239. Patrick Schlievert was a university professor, and he and his wife filed a joint return in which they claimed deductions for the operation of a business which was a record label. The operation of this business was really for the benefit of their daughter, who had discovered a band and wanted to produce their records. Dr. Schlievert was a successful scientist. He had created and co-founded a couple of biotechnology companies. He had significant ordinary income. Sarah, his only child, attended the University of Southern California, majored in music, the music industry, interned at Atlantic Records, discovered a band, and wanted to be a record producer. Dr. Schlievert decided to fund her enterprise. The record label only represented the one band, Sarah paid the expenses out of her personal bank account and then was reimbursed by her mother and father. The Schedule C under examination for 2010 reported a $44,445 net loss, resulting from advertising, commissions and fees, about $24,000 of legal and professional services, almost $12,000 of travel expenses, and no gross receipts or sales. Now, zero on a income, zero gross receipts on a Schedule C that shows a $44,000 loss is a sure ticket to an audit in my book, but the Schlieverts filed the return, and the IRS audited the return, and they disallowed the losses and got to the tax court, and the tax court applied the nine factors: the manner in which the taxpayer conducted the activity, the expertise of the taxpayer, the time and effort, expectation of appreciation, etc. The taxpayer lost most of those, and they lost their deduction, as they should have. Our next case, Jeffrey J. Furnish, F-U-R-N-I-S-H, TC Summary Opinion 2013-81, should have been decided in the IRS's favor. It is a classic case of an individual who purchases a life insurance policy, makes a few premium payments, and then proceeds to stop making payments, but the policy stays alive and the premium payments are made with policy loans. Because the premiums in the first 3 or 4 years were sufficient to provide cash value over the years, and the assumed premium payments from the policy loans provided an additional cash value, policy continued in force for a long time. After, I presume, the individual had forgotten that the policy was in fact in place, although you get a notice from the insurance company every year. In any event, Mr. Furnish received a Form 1099, received information from the insurance company when this policy finally ate itself up. When there was no longer enough money in the accumulated cash value to pay the premium, he received a notice that he had taxable income, and that's how it usually works. Back in the 1970s, Mr. Furnish purchased two policies from Northwestern Mutual Life, both of which had a feature that would automatically loan the money to pay the premium if he didn't. He paid the first few premiums, so he actually has some basis in these policies. But then the policies became self-sustaining until, of course, the cost of insurance was exceeding the annual internal earnings in the policy fund, and that's what happens. So in 2009, these policies were about to lapse unless Mr. Furnish made additional premium payments. He didn't make any premium payments. Northwestern Mutual determined that the insurance policies had lapsed. They sent Mr. Furnish a Form 1099-R for 2009, reporting a gross distribution of $78,414.14, which was the cash value of the two policies, designating $49,255.24 as taxable income. And that's the benefits he received in excess of the amount of premiums that were paid. And by the way, the court will usually give deference to the Form 1099-R. Time and again, the taxpayers have tried to argue that a 1099 or a 1099-R did not properly report the income, and the court makes short work of that. They say, no, the 1099-R we accept as valid on its face unless you can prove that it isn't. But Mr. Furnish argued that he didn't have to prove that it wasn't. The IRS had to prove that it was. At the end of the day, after Mr. Furnish engaged in correspondence and phone calls with the IRS, he took up the issue right away when he got the 1099. He argued that this was a phantom distribution of $49,255.24 that he never got. But the truth is, he got the benefit of the insurance coverage. So the $49,255.24 is income to him because it was the value of the life insurance premiums that were paid over the years with those loans. There is no doubt that Mr. Furnish caught a break. He got a judge that apparently didn't understand taxes all that well, but the judge concluded that because Mr. Furnish had cooperated, because he had provided all kinds of information, he had in fact shifted the burden of production to the Internal Revenue Service, and the IRS failed to produce reasonable and probative information regarding the accuracy of the Form 1099-R. That's one for the Christians, and they don't win very many. The Lions usually win them. Finally, this week, a Program Manager Technical Assistance Memorandum, 2013-011, on determining the timeliness of a collection due process or an equivalent hearing request. The technical advice answers two questions. One, if a taxpayer sends a CDP hearing request to an incorrect IRS office, and that office receives the request before the statutory deadline, but incorrectly forwards it directly to appeals, which results in the correct collection office receiving the request after the statutory deadline, has the taxpayer made a timely hearing request? The answer is no. A collection due process hearing request that is not received by the proper processing office before the statutory deadline is not timely, but the taxpayer may be eligible for an equivalent hearing. Now, the lesson for us is, as advisors, we need to make sure we send the hearing request to the correct office. Question number two. If a taxpayer sends a written request for an equivalent levy hearing and a collection due process lien hearing to only the office specified in the taxpayer's lien notice, but not also to the office specified in the taxpayer's levy notice, should the taxpayer be required to submit a proper equivalent levy hearing request before appeals grants both hearings from the proper lien hearing request? The answer to that one is slightly more taxpayer favorable. No. There is no legal barrier to appeals granting both the collection due process lien hearing and the equivalent levy hearing from the proper lien hearing request. Well, that's a wrap for this week. As usual, our advice, stay safe.